when Prophet Lut alayhi salam is ready to allow his daughters to marry such people, it means that such relations in and of itself does not prove anything. Mm-hmm. But here in this case, why Prophet Lut alayhi salam is suggesting that? Because of a more important expediency. They are going to commit a great sin to somehow, harass and bother the guests of Prophet Lut alayhi salam, who are angels. Yeah, and this is an illegal action.
Yes.
But Prophet Lut alayhi salam is suggesting at least a legal action, so that to prevent a very illegal action. We're talking about sodomy.
So the first reason is to prevent something very bad.
Yeah, that's the point.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, when it comes to, let's talk about our Prophet and his wives and his fathers-in-law. We know that mainly we're talking about Aisha, the daughter of the first caliph, and Hafsa, the daughter of the second caliph. Mm-hmm. Again, they are the wives of the Prophet. They are Ummul Mu'mineen, but it doesn't mean that they are, immune from any mistake. They are infallible.
Exactly.
No, they are. Like any other person, they are responsible for their actions. And especially regarding these two wives, Aisha and Hafsa, we have a verse in the Noble Book of Quran in chapter Tahrim, because of the fact that in some cases they bothered the Prophet. And this is not a claim by the Shia. This has been mentioned in Sunni sources as well. To the extent that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses a very threatening tone, chapter Tahrim, verse 5, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم عسى ربه إن طلقكن. It may be that if he, that is the Prophet, divorces you, أَيُّبْدِلَهُ أَزْوَاجًا خَيْرًا مِنْ كُنَّ. His Lord will give him, in your stead, wives better than you. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explains about those wives. So this is one indication from the Noble Book of Quran that, again, to be the wife of the Prophet does not guarantee that you are a virtuous lady. No, you're responsible like any other.
And actually, the Prophet had some goals and some messages from marrying those people,
mm-hmm.
because they were an entire different tribe. Therefore, in order to extend Islam, and in order to have more power than the others,
that's a very,
this marriage happened.
Valid point, and let me refer to more details in this regard about the tribes. Yeah, the tribal relations mattered a lot in that time.
In those times.
Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr, was from the tribe of Taim. Hafsa was from the big tribe of Adi.
And they were very large tribes.
Exactly.
So they had very important power.
And I will explain how these marriages of the Prophet prevented many wars.
Exactly.
And how they were attracted to the Prophet.
Many people.
That's the point. And many of them converted to the religion of Islam.
Exactly.
Another wife of the Prophet is Umm Habiba, the daughter of Abu Sufyan from the famous tribe of Banu Umayya. Can we say that so Abu Sufyan is a very holy man because his daughter has married the Prophet? Of course not.
Of course not.
Umm Salama is from the tribe of Bani Makhzum. Suda is from Bani Asad. Maymuna is from Bani Hilal. And Safiya belongs to the Jews of Bani Musalak. So, he was an ex-Jewish person. So, on that time, marriage between two tribes meant a lot.
Exactly.
Now you are a person related to that tribe too. Which
and
means
of
that
course, Islam was new at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They had to work on it and let that tree grow and have some fruits.
Exactly, that's the point. And interestingly, we do not see the marriage between the Prophet and the tribes of Ansar, the helpers.
Mm-hmm.
Because according to some scholars, there was no threat from
coming this from
side, coming from the Ansar. All the threats were coming from the Quraysh or from the Jewish people.
Exactly.
And that is why in many cases the Holy Prophet marries a lady.
Daughter in order to save other people.
Exactly. This Christian author writes that Prophet Muhammad married Umm Habiba so that he would be the son-in-law of Abu Sufyan, and this way he decreased the enmity of the Quraysh and Banu Umayyah. And they were happy that a person like the Prophet has married a woman from that tribe. It's been mentioned that Umm Salama, when the Prophet married Umm Salama from Banu Makhzum, the same tribe of Abu Jahl and Khalid ibn Walid, from that time onwards, we know that Khalid ibn Walid was one of the greatest enemies of the Prophet. But after this marriage, he somehow, he changed a lot, and finally he embraced Islam as well. The same is true about Juwayriya and Safiya, who belonged to Bani Nadir, Bani Mustalaq, and so on and so forth. So my point is that when it comes to the marriages of the Prophet, in many cases the Holy Prophet married these people in order for him to attract the attention of the people of
into
those
Islam.
Tribes. And
so just to wrap it up, I would say that these marriages, at those times, marriage was not just a matter of marriage itself. It was more of extension of Islam.
Exactly.
So that is the point. You were listening to Q&A on Islamic Belief. This is Arab English Radio. Thank you for listening. Until another episode, I bid you farewell.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government. Particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Russian forces and their allies have gained full control of the town of Lyman in the Donetsk region. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The railway hub lies on the road to the key cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which are still under Kiev's control. It is also located 40 kilometers west of the largest Donbass city of Severodonetsk, the current focus of the Russian offensive in the east. Luhansk's governor says Russian troops have entered Severodonetsk. Elsewhere in the south, local authorities say the southwestern Ukrainian port city of Mykolaiv came under Russian shelling on Saturday. The city is 60 kilometers from the Russian-held city of Kherson. Also, according to a regional military governor, Russian forces have pounded the district of the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv.
The road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias. The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. But we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base. The remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike. Now these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive." As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this in the coming days and weeks will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer, but they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bourizza, London.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome. Known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation, Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected, and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem, drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American toady, and this act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Ku San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interest.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hello, Commander. It's the title of a new epic song themed with support for the Islamic Revolution and its leader from the mouth of Iranian children. The pop choir has recently been chanted in every corner in Iran, from TV shows to schools and public places. On Thursday, some 100,000 people jam-packed Tehran's Azadi Stadium to sing along Salam Farmande, Persian for Hello Commander.
Although we have not seen the Islamic revolution, but we as the new generation will hold on to the ideals of the revolution and our leader. This is the theme of this song.
Hello Commander is about Imam Mahdi. In the song, we urge Imam Mahdi's hasty arrival to save humankind from cruelty.
The song addresses Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam and the prophesied apocalyptic savior in Shia Islam, who is believed to be currently living in occultation.
I brought my children to this gathering because they love Imam Mahdi. Here, they learn to be the soldiers of Imam Mahdi.
I came to show my love for Imam Mahdi. In the song, we assure our leader that we will be loyal to Imam Mahdi.
In a part of the song, children promise Imam Mahdi that they will tread on the path of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' Quds Force commander, who was assassinated by the United States in Iraq in 2020.
In this song, we as the new generation vow to be the next Qasem Soleimani. We are proud of him because he brought us security. I wish he was here today.
The song was first broadcast from Iran's national television on March 20th this year, after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a televised Persian New Year speech. Since then, the song has been performed in schools and national public occasions as a show of support for the Islamic Republic.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism," and some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member. It sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol Airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the Library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found stingers and javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine. Not least because, unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
Fresh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week. With the gun massacre in East Buffalo, followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and printed in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, U.S. Leaders Are Failing in Their Most Basic Duty. The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week, with the gun massacre in East Buffalo followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? There is incredulity at the inaction of the police in Uvalde, Texas. 78 minutes elapsed after the gunman walked inside before police, believing there were no kids at risk, finally confronted him, according to Stephen McGraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety. Meanwhile, 911 dispatchers received several calls from inside the classroom, including repeated calls from a child begging them to send in the police. By the end of his rampage, the gunman had killed 19 children and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. Stephen McGraw acknowledged the multiple failures of judgment. In response to a question about whether the commander at the scene should offer an apology to the victims' families, he said, "If I thought it would help, I would apologize." Police held back a group of horrified parents who gathered even as shots continued to ring out inside the school, and begged police officers to move in and try to rescue their children. At least one mother was put in handcuffs only to spring over a fence and sprint into the school to scoop up her child when the opportunity presented itself. The police, she said, were doing nothing. Those officers had been training for years for just such an attack, yet when the moment came, all that preparation did nothing to stop a gunman wielding an assault rifle in a school full of children. There is unspeakable grief over the deaths of children like Layla Salazar, who'd like to make TikTok videos, wear denim jackets and sing Sweet Child O' Mine on the way to school each morning. "They took her away from us," Layla's grandfather, Vincent Salazar, told the New York Times. "How do you mend a broken heart from a family as close as we had?" Irma Garcia, a teacher at the Robb Elementary School, liked classic rock. Her body was found with children still in her embrace, according to her nephew. A fourth grader who survived the attack said that Ms. Garcia and another teacher, Iva Mireles, had saved his and other students' lives. They were in front of my classmates to help, he said, to save them. There is also a profound sense of national exhaustion that comes when tragedy is layered upon tragedy. In Buffalo, three funerals were held on Friday for victims of the mass shooting that took place at a supermarket on 14th of May. 10 people were killed in that attack and 3 others were wounded. It's like Groundhog's Day. We've seen this over and over again. Mark Talley, the son of one of the victims, Geraldine Talley, said at a news conference on Thursday, 26th of May. In Buffalo, a white gunman targeted a predominantly black neighborhood with his AR-15-style assault rifle. He was an adherent of the racist conspiracy theory known as replacement theory, which posits that white Americans are being displaced by immigrants and people of color. Nearly half of the Republicans told pollsters recently that they agree with the general thesis that a cabal of powerful people is encouraging immigrants to come to the United States to sway politics. The combination of paranoia and firearms has led to tragedy again and again. Why are we willing to live with this carnage? President Biden asked the nation on Tuesday, 24th of May. The report of each gunshot in a mass killing echoes long after the next killing eclipses it. According to his family, Joe Garcia, Irma Garcia's husband, died on Thursday, 26th of May, of a heart attack. Mr. Garcia, a 50-year-old, had just gotten home from the memorial for his wife on Thursday morning when he collapsed. It is entirely reasonable to ask how much more of this a nation can be expected to bear. The answer is infuriating. There have been 213 mass shootings in the United States in the first 21 weeks of 2022. An average of 321 Americans are shot every single day. And every day, there are roughly more than 50,000 gun sales recorded in the U.S. Properly maintained, those guns will fire like new for decades. There was some hope after a massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, which left 20 children and 6 teachers dead, that America had finally reached the limit of tragedy it could withstand, and that perhaps the gun lobby had reached the high water mark of its power. A decade later, neither of those holds true. On Friday, the former president, Donald Trump, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina all spoke at the annual convention of the National Rifles Association, NRA, in Houston, Texas, just a few hours' drive from Uvalde. There is no better manifestation of the gun lobby's total capture of so much of the Republican Party. States around the country have made halting but commendable progress in passing sensible gun safety measures, red flag laws, background checks, and age of purchase requirements. They face stiff headwinds. A federal court this month struck down a California law that set the age limit for purchasing semi-automatic weapons at 21. But the legislature is now considering other promising bills that would limit the advertising of certain guns to children and allow Californians to sue gun makers. Anything that introduces friction into the system of gun acquisition is to the good. In New York this week, a federal judge tossed out a challenge from gun groups to a law that allows civil lawsuits against companies that have endangered public safety. And New York Governor Kathy Hochul called on the legislature to raise the age limit to purchase some assault weapons to 21. The shooter in Texas waited until his 18th birthday to buy a pair of assault weapons and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. In Washington, D.C., there is talk that Republican and Democratic lawmakers might make a deal on some type of national red flag law, which would allow the police to take guns away from people judged to be an imminent danger either to themselves or to others. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, has been leading a bipartisan group of senators that is considering establishing a more comprehensive federal background check system, a reform supported by 88% of the American public. We have seen these bipartisan efforts on gun safety measures come and go without results. Still, in the face of Republican intransigence, Democrats, and President Biden in particular, should do whatever they can. Senator Chris Murphy, who has led the charge for tougher gun regulations since Sandy Hook, put it well on the floor of the Senate this past week. "What are we doing?" he asked his colleagues. "Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority?" he wondered. "If the answer is to do nothing, as the slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives." It's a question that speaks to the Senate directly and the entire system of American government more broadly. Yes, the country's democratic system represents a diversity of views in the country on guns. But as currently structured, Congress is fundamentally unresponsive to the needs of its most vulnerable citizens and has been corrupted by powerful interest groups, allowing those groups to block even modest changes to laws that the vast majority of Americans support. We, the American public, all share this vast country and need to figure out how to make it better and keep one another alive and thriving. Right now, we're falling at that primary responsibility. There are glimmers of hope, especially at the state level, that things are changing. But even there, progress is agonizingly slow and won't be enough for the hundreds of Americans who will be shot today and tomorrow and every day until action is taken.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Well, I'm innocent compared to many.
So am I.
Is there anyone who could claim that I'm innocent compared to many?
Everyone does. I mean, it's a human instinct. No one thinks they are bad.
When you're a kid, you used to say that in order to tell your parents how good of a children you are.
No, even now. It's just, like I said, this is a human nature. No one thinks that they're bad. I mean, even bad people think they are innocent.
Mm.
It's just that's how we're in tune, because we're in tune.
So we all are innocent.
In our own minds?
Yes,
yes we are. Doesn't mean that we are, though, in reality. So, I mean, I think I'm better than everybody, and everyone thinks they are better than everyone else. I think it's just the way our minds works.
So now that you think you're innocent, tell me, what does innocent mean? I would tell you my idea of innocence.
I don't know. I mean, everyone have their own definition of innocence, but at least from my perspective,
how would you call it?
There are two dimensions to it, but I will just share one. I mean, innocence is when, in my opinion, is that when your heart is so pure that you have nothing, like nothing against anyone else. Like, you don't want to harm them. You don't do anything wrong by them. And even when they do things bad to you, you just overlook it. I mean, that's my definition of innocence. Like, I mean, you have that pure heart that you just don't do harm to anyone.
Yes, that is a part of innocence.
Yeah,
having a pure heart. I would say that innocence is synonymous with being inexperienced.
No, actually, we call that gullible. That's not innocence. That's a different story.
Yes, it could
be. No, no. A person is innocent. It's not a person. See, we call that...
The less you
like
know.
You know how neuron they call them, mm-hmm. like, plain?
Yes.
So I think each culture that I've been through, they have a word for those people who are... They're not innocent, but they are in a way where they are just... Like the vegetables, like, you know, like they don't have much information.
Exactly, that's what I'm
but
saying.
But that's not innocence.
Why? Why? It's also.
I mean,
part
they
of innocence.
Might have innocence in them.
Yes.
But they're just people who are, at least to say the least, not educated. They're just simple people.
See, if I'm not innocent or plain, as you call it, or inexperienced, as they call it, then I would have learned many things in my life. In order to deceive people, in order to do different sort of things.
No, see, even like I said, we say everyone needs to be innocent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Innocent in the sense that they're keeping themselves clean. Like, when it comes to Allah, obviously, they need to stay away from sin. So they're
yes.
innocent from that side. Because mm-hmm. because when we say innocent, it's the opposite of crime, right?
Yes.
So when you're either innocent or you either committed a crime, you're a criminal. So, correct? So when I'm not committing a crime, they say to me what? You're innocent.
That's a very general classification of the world.
Well, that's the idea. So when you're innocent...
No, it has changed by time. Now, innocence is, I guess, in front of innocence, we could put, as I told you, experience. We have songs of innocence,
so
songs of experience.
I mean, you could either have experienced people or inexperienced people.
No,
I mean, you can't.
No, even in poetry we have that. We call that songs of innocence, which is the time that you do not know anything. You are, as you put it, very clean. There's nothing
that... Yeah, so one thing, this child is innocent. Do they mean that he's not experienced, or do they mean that he hasn't committed a crime? He hasn't done anything wrong by people?
He has not had enough experience. He's clean, he's pure, he's a clean book
or he's a clean slate, as we say.
Okay, it's a clean slate, but it does not stand in front of crime. Innocent.
Yeah, so with experience, mm-hmm. he gets to learn to become a person of deviation and causes havoc and hurts and harms people.
Leads
around.
Into crime.
Yeah, so obviously experience will lead him to commit crimes that takes away his innocence. But some people, they are experienced, they are learned, they are... you know, old men and women, mm-hmm. but they're still innocent. Innocent in the sense that they have no hatred, they have, you know, no harm, they have nothing against other people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you sit with them, and I've seen a lot of people, when you sit with them, you could feel the innocence in them, that you could feel
exactly.
their fitrah and their heart are just pure, that you can actually
it's
sense
so
it.
It's so tangible in them.
Yeah. So, and not you can't say these people are inexperienced. Like they could, you know, I've seen people who are reached the stage of maraja, and you sit next to them and you feel this aroma and this essence to their innocence. You know what I mean?
Yes,
because
sir.
They haven't done anything wrong. This is at least for my own. This is how I define innocence. Sometimes we call people naive.
Naive, yes.
Right? It's like we say, you're so naive. It's like you just don't want to accept reality. You're just seeing things in a different perspective. Like, maybe that person is not naive. He's just innocent. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, they say to me, sister asthma is really bad. You have no idea what she's... I'm like, I don't care. To me, she's good. That's what matters.
Uh-huh.
So people say to me, you're very naive.
Another point.
You're very naive. And I'm like, no, I'm trying to preserve my innocence when it comes to looking at people.
So
I don't want
innocent
to corrupt
people
it.
Might look naive?
Innocent people might look naive?
Mm-hmm.
In a way, yeah. To others, yes.
Yes.
See, I get called naive many other times, a lot of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And when they call me naive, I accept it. But in my opinion, I'm like... No, I'm not naive. I just rather not have these thoughts on my mind.
You're just playing innocent.
Yeah, I don't have these thoughts on my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes like, oh, no, this is how it is. This is. I'm like, I don't care.
Yes.
Don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Mm-hmm. What happens to human beings through the ages that they would turn their innocence, which remind us of our childhood, into a sort of experienced people who know many things and who are changed, and there are different curtains in their hearts, and you cannot see beyond their eyes. But through age, I guess, as we grow older, this innocence might fade away as we grow older and we get more experienced.
Yeah, obviously, the more you learn, the more you go through life. I mean, the more this, it's just the fitra, the innate that we have gets polluted.
So I guess inevitably, after you grow older, innocence would fade away, believe it or not.
Well, I mean, it depends. If you don't maintain it, it will fade away. Definitely. You know the hadith that says the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, he used to love sitting with children. He says, I love sitting with because they are innocent. In the sense that they haven't committed any crime or any sin towards God, and they're just pure. And he would like to spend a lot of time with them. As we get older, obviously, because we go through life and stuff, we accumulate a lot of that dust on our hearts, and it kind of takes our innocence. But a lot of people maintain it and keep it. And
but it's very difficult.
Well, no one said it's easy.
You know that dust you talk about, it's very difficult.
No one said it's easy.
Yes.
But it's doable. It's achievable.
It's going to be a drudgery.
Yeah, even the Quran says, إِلَّا مَنْ أَتَى اللَّهُ بِقَلْبٍ سَلِيمٍ. So you need to come to God with this immaculate heart, meaning that it's innocent, it hasn't done anything wrong. I mean, especially in our modern day, where this whole world became a village, it's extremely hard. Back in the day, it would be a lot easier because you would live in your own village and you don't know what's happening even to your next door neighbor. Now I know what happened to my friend or my relatives who are continents away.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's very hard in our day, but it's doable. We can maintain this innocence. Or at least we could work on it. You know, even if someone, lost their innocence, they could go back and, I don't know, try to clean it or cleanse it. It's possible.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, speaking of innocence, we are talking of innocence, which we learned that maybe innocent people might look naive, but actually they are working on themselves and they're maintaining the innocence they had in their childhood.
But they're also, there are naive people though.
They're naive. Yes, I told you that was what I was telling you at the very beginning.
They are innocent and they are naive people because they are just truly dumb, stupid.
That was what I told you, being unexperienced.
Yeah, so I'm just saying it out loud so people don't think that I look at everyone naive person as an innocent person. No. Because sometimes we have just stupid people.
Yes.
They accept reality, but we call them naive. But there are naive people who, innocent, but sometimes we falsely accuse them of being naive.
Yes. The difference is understandable, When you see that, you can get which one is true. Is it naivety or is it innocence?
I mean, I can't tell, but they can, like the people themselves. I mean, when I call you naive, you could just try to maintain your innocence, but I'm looking at you as a naive person who's at least not experienced or not intellectual nor smart.
Just imagine if there was a world in which we couldn't judge our fellows as criminals or as innocent people. Would that be possible to live in a situation where you're not judging people for being innocent or for being criminal?
I think it's impossible because human beings in their nature, we are very judgmental.
Exactly,
because
yes.
We need that kind of judgment.
But just imagine it's a movie and then you have this ability in order to ignore people's bad habits or the criminal side of them or the innocence. I mean,
If you could ignore it?
Yes. You could ignore just he is criminal or he is innocent.
I mean, is that like one person or everybody?
Everybody. We don't care about each other as being criminal. I mean, or that innocent.
Would. I mean, if you don't get to judge,
would it
people,
be a good thing?
It would be a good thing that if no one else, I mean, to a certain extent is good, to a certain extent is bad because it will collide with a lot of things. Now, the first thing that comes to my mind is that Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar, right? Mm-hmm. When I see committing a crime or doing something like haram, I could say, well, it's not my problem. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just going to ignore it and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens to my role of trying to come and do Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar? I can't let anyone go with a crime. I have to come and say, well, what you're doing is wrong and needs to stop.
But maybe also in another
dimension.
Yes. That criminal person, if we consider him as innocent, then he might change into an innocent person.
You consider him as innocent, but does he see himself as you, what you consider him? Like, for example, when I look at you now, I say, well, she's innocent. Are you feeling it?
No,
you are you feeling me calling you innocent?
As a imagine you're the boss and I'm coming to you. I'm a criminal and then you don't know that. If you give me the opportunity to put myself in a situation in which I am totally occupied by different sort of jobs, then maybe that idea of crime would get away from my head.
It could pass. I mean, it's a 50-50. If you know, in example, if I was at work and you were the boss, mm-hmm. and I'm doing a crime and I saw that you're turning a blind eye, I said, you know what, I'm just going to let it go. I'm just going to maintain my innocence.
But I think the world does not give criminals any chance.
No, so that's what I'm saying. So I'm saying if you do that, the criminal might say, well, you know what, she's being really nice. She did not do anything and she looked at me as innocent. She tried to pretend that I did not do what I did. I might, let me change. That's possible. On the other hand, it's like, oh, she didn't do anything. Let me do the second thing. So it could also lead.
Yes.
To, it could go
yes,
bad.
Yes, as you said, it's a 50-50 situation.
Yeah. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if it comes to a time where the majority of people are corrupted, then have doubts. When the majority of people are good, then don't have doubts. Like, don't doubt people.
How do we know the majority of people are?
I mean, to assume that everyone is innocent would be the
wrong
thing
know,
to do.
But, you know, I always say that human nature is in a way that we cannot give a rule about them. We could not say that, okay, it's bad or it's good. It's always in a situation of moderate so that you don't understand which one is the majority.
We based on what we have, we can give a general rule, mm-hmm. but we don't apply it to everyone. When I deal with individuals, it's a different story. I can't look at you and say, well, you're corrupted. Why? The society we live in is corrupted. No. I mean, there are specifics. There are people, when you know, the ones I deal with, the ones that I know, at least I give them the benefit of the doubt.
We talked about some very useful issues. Thank you for joining us, dear listeners. We were talking about innocence and criminals. Then we talked about criminals as well. So again, thank you for listening. This was Youth Station, IRB English Radio. I was very happy to be with you. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.